is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
American foreign policy and the word isolationism. I welcome John Bolton, former ambassador to the United Nations, former national security advisor, writing most recently at the National Review Online, about American foreign policy since the beginning, since George Washington, but also the word isolationism that was created in the 20th century as a disputatious point, but here in the 21st century is now entertained again by some members of the grand old party. What is to be done? John, a very good evening to you. I want to establish, as you do in your essay, that the U.S. has always been engaged in the world. There was never an isolationist moment in the late 18th century with George Washington and John Adams. A quasi-war comes to mind, something we all had to memorize in grade school. And then we come to the 19th century from the Louisiana Purchase until the Spanish-American War. Engage, engage, engage. Was isolationism a debating point in the 19th century, John, up to Roosevelt? Good evening to you.
Good evening. No, it really wasn't. And I thought it was important in this piece in National Review to write, even if only at Calvin Coolidge length, why the idea that America was just sitting for over a century quietly knitting by the fire, protected by two broad oceans and uninterested in the affairs of the world, because it dominates the view both of the left, who think that that our involvement in the world starts with Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt, and those on the right who are reviving the problem of isolationism. The whole view of America as an inward-looking insular country is wrong from the very beginning of our history. And the short summary to me begins in 1783, when a ship called the Empress of China sailed for Asia. The very year that we got our independence, that ship was launched. But throughout the 19th century, spreading from a relatively small series of settlements along the East Coast, given huge territory by our independence treaty at Versailles in 1783, through the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, which doubled the size of the country through one territorial acquisition after another, we moved all the way across the continent. And for many, many other aspects, including deployments of our Navy, fighting the Barbary pirates in North Africa in Jefferson's administration. Why? Because the Europeans wouldn't do it. That shows we were out protecting our interests all around the world. We knew what we were up to. We were the last thing that you could imagine as a bunch of stay-at-homers. And understanding that, I think, is critical for Americans today when they're confronted by these arguments that we're best advised to stay out of the world. We pushed ourselves into the world. We are probably more responsible for the creation of the modern world over time than any other country in the 19th and 20th centuries. And we did it because we wanted to.
Let's have some fun, John. Why not? Henry Cabot Lodge. Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt working together, moving from continental concerns to hemispheric concerns, you write. What does that mean, John?
Well, I think this is something that that really shows in the late 19th century, when Woodrow Wilson was just a professor at Princeton, the Republican Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge, who was really the great theoretician of Republican foreign policy in the Senate during that period, were looking to make America stronger, to reinforce its interest around the world. Henry Cabot Lodge was one of the main supporters for the annexation of Hawaii, to keep the British out, to keep the Japanese out, pushing America halfway across the Pacific Ocean. Theodore Roosevelt, even less of a stay at home, created the country of Panama by splitting Colombia, and did something that people had talked about for a century but were unable to do, and built the Panama Canal, linking the two oceans, an enormous benefit for the United States and for the rest of the world. And then pushing it through a variety of other things, solving a war between Russia and Japan. People say, well, what's our interest in that? Stability in the Western Pacific was our interest. And then the next year, in 1907, sending America's Great White Fleet around the world. And basically saying to the world, take a look at this. And Henry Cabot Lodge, after World War I, trying to get reservations that would protect American sovereignty, attached to Woodrow Wilson's Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations, Wilson refusing, and the league goes down, not because of American isolationism, but because of Woodrow Wilson's own arrogance. The Republican Roosevelt and Wilson are really the key points at the opposite end of the spectrum. Woodrow Wilson says our purpose in World War I is to make the world safe for democracy. This is the classic statement of liberal internationalism. We're just out there to do good in the world. Franklin Roosevelt gave the Republican reply when he said, first, we are to make the world safe for ourselves. So I think by that point, the end of World War One, we really had the issue joined that brackets the debate from that point until the present.
The arsenal of democracy, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Winston Churchill realizing with the attack on Pearl Harbor that Britain would win. Why, John? What did Churchill know? What did Roosevelt know about our abilities to project?
Well, I think they both understood that once the great American economy was moved to a war footing, there was simply no way that any other country in the world could stand up to our economic capabilities. And in fact, although there were a lot of chancy encounters and difficult struggles, and we had enormously brave troops and sailors led by some fantastic flag officers, overwhelmingly America's industrial capacity won the war for the Allies. And that's really what carried through after 1945. Again, despite Roosevelt trying to resurrect Woodrow Wilson's multilateral liberal internationalism in the United Nations, it's not the United Nations that's kept the world in even a small sense of order and peace since then. It's been the work of the United States and its allies, and we're still the beneficiaries of that very contingent and partial world order even today.
The success of the Cold War, from Truman and Eisenhower to what happens George H.W. Bush at the close, and even Bill Clinton, there were great successes, but there was a failure at the end to understand that the history had not ended. Was that informed by the isolationist camp that never existed? Why did we end the Cold War so sloppily that we're now living with the ghosts?
Well, I think it reflects a lot of the naivete of liberal internationalism, frankly, because these were exactly the same people who didn't want to take the hard line that Ronald Reagan followed and that resulted in the collapse of the Soviet Union when George H.W. Bush was president. So that's why they thought we had reached the end of history. That's why they thought we had a peace dividend where we could dramatically reduce military expenditures, weaken our position around the world, forgetting Ronald Reagan's key point of peace through strength. And the old Roman adage, which George Washington quoted in effect in his first State of the Union message, si vis pacem, para bellum. If you want peace, prepare for war. The Clinton administration wanted peace, but they didn't prepare for war, and we're suffering the consequences today.
And now we come to the 21st century. John Bolton, former ambassador to the United Nations, former national security advisor, writing at the National Review Online about America in the world and the isolationist shadows. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.